The conversation around protecting dreamers, especially on college campuses, continues both in Illinois and in Washington. Here's Dick Durbin speaking yesterday from the Senate floor.
To give these DACA eligibles a temporary reprieve so that if there's elimination of this executive order, we don't eliminate the protection that keeps them here in the United States.
That comes as the University of Illinois President Timothy Clean said the university's three campuses will not be declared sanctuaries. We'll talk about what all this means this hour. Plus,
I'm here to see Santa today and ask if I can have my elf back.
I'm going to say I want American Girl doll stuff for Christmas.
I'm of the opinion that if we start her early, then she'll understand this is a friendly experience and not something to be scared about.
We'll talk with a pediatrician who has advice for parents of little ones who might be scared of Santa, and a very special guest, Santa himself, will pay us a visit in studio. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the University of Illinois said that the school would not become a sanctuary campus. In fact, not for any of its three campuses across Illinois, but that it would do everything it could within the law to reassure, support, and protect all of its students, including, it said, its undocumented students. That's in response to requests from faculty, staff, and students that the university become a sanctuary campus. The U of I is about 100 schools across the country where students are asking administrators to declare it a, quote, sanctuary campus. The problem, as university officials have pointed out, is there's no specific legal definition of what this means. This comes as lots of cities and communities are moving to declare themselves sanctuary places. And it also comes today as Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, along with 18 other mayors from some of our biggest cities, including Houston, Boston, New York, and L.A., and smaller cities like St. Louis, sent a letter to President-elect Trump urging him to continue the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but first, we wanted to focus on the sanctuary campus issue. Joining me now is one person from a group of faculty members who's been petitioning the University of Illinois administration. Naomi Paik is an assistant professor in the Department of Asian American Studies. Professor Paik, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think part of the confusion is what a sanctuary campus means. For those of you who have been asking the University of Illinois to create this, what would you like that to look like?
So, first of all, I think that the openness of the term sanctuary actually can be a benefit to us. So we can define it on our campus and to each local environment the way that we see fit. I understand President Killeen's concern about the openness of that term and that the fact that it doesn't have a strict legal definition. And I also want to emphasize that getting kind of locked into what does this term mean is a little bit of a distraction. Our main concern is protecting our students and our community members who don't have documented status here. So our priority is to get policies into place and get a kind of social milieu into place that protects these people from what might be coming. In terms of what we are looking for, we see this as kind of a two-pronged issue. So one is about the social environment of our campus and our community. So thinking about the acts of racial hostility that kind of were amplified and incited by the recent election. Okay, so that's one part of it. So what steps can we take to ensure that we have the kind of welcoming, hospitable community that we really cherish? And that's why, you know, that's one of the things that brought me here, why I wanted to work here. The other part is, what kind of policies can we put into place to protect these students? So, for example, if DACA is eliminated on January 21st, what can we do to make sure that these students can have some kind of work authorization or still have some kinds of sources of funding? What kinds of policies can we put into place, to make sure that immigration authorities don't necessarily voluntarily cooperate with ICE agents, right?
This does not. And that's something other campuses have said.
Yes.
For example, I know President-elect Trump's alma mater, actually, the University of Pennsylvania, they
yes.
said last week to students in an email, the president, they wouldn't allow federal immigration authorities mm-hmm. on campus unless they had a warrant. I should say we did reach out to the University of Illinois. President Killeen wasn't available to join us, but they did give the 21st a statement. They said, just to reiterate what you were saying, they feel like the sanctuary concept is very nebulous. And they said, that there are demands and petitions and the expectation of a sanctuary campus, anything that would suggest that the University of Illinois would not comply with federal or state laws that could possibly risk federal funding or other potential sanctions, the university is not going to do that. Mm-hmm. What the university will continue to do, they said, is to be a student-centered place that it always has been, to continue to protect all students, including students, it says, who are undocumented. Mm-hmm. To your mind, does that go far enough?
I mean, I think we are on the same page. We see the administration as our, you know, people that we want to work with. We actually need to work with them. And I am very heartened by the statement, the reaffirmation that one of their priorities is to ensure that undocumented students and undocumented community members have a place at the University of Illinois. So that's our ground floor right now. I think the question is, how do we make that happen? Right. And so I understand what they're saying about the term sanctuary. I understand what they're saying about wanting to be in compliance with the law. If you actually so some of the things that we're thinking of are not about open violation of the law. It's more about working within the limits of the law to give undocumented students on our campus the strongest possible protections that we are able to offer them.
So to be clear, you are not asking, the faculty are not asking the university to necessarily defy existing state or federal laws.
No. So there's a lot of things that we could do that would still be fully compliant with the law, but that would not voluntarily work with
like
ICE.
What? What are you thinking?
Okay. So first of all, our first request on the letter is to protect student privacy and to not comply with immigration authorities when it comes to deportations, right, or raids. Okay, this is already ensured by things like FERPA, right? So FERPA ensures student privacy on all campuses. So that is more of a reaffirmation of federal policy already. The other thing is that ICE considers all educational sites as what they call sensitive locations. So hospitals, schools, churches, any kind of religious organization. These are all sensitive locations where they, as policy, do not infringe on the on those sites to do things like raids, investigations, interrogations, anything like that.
So it sounds like you're saying there are already sanctuaries, maybe in not the because, again, there's not a legal term, but it certainly sounds like from just a common sense explanation. Mm-hmm. Would you say that legally already college campuses are sanctuaries?
Well, I mean, this, again, gets back to the openness of the term, right? And then also, you know, I think our concern is that we don't know what's going to happen come January 21st. Trump may, you know, encourage, compel ICE to change that policy and to do away with sensitive locations altogether. If something like that were to happen, what then would we do? You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I think the other stronger statements of support of undocumented students from other campuses, like from the University of California or University of Pennsylvania that you mentioned, they say that ICE would have to come and get a warrant, right? Or they would have to get some kind of additional documentation that we that tells us we have to comply.
It sounds like you also, it almost seems like you want the university to also take a symbolic stand. Do you feel like President Killeen's statement yesterday was enough?
The part about President Killeen's statement that I'm hanging on to is that he affirmed that that the University of Illinois is committed to all of its students and community members, including the undocumented. And so that is the main part of the statement that I find very encouraging. So I think that as we move forward, I would like to see a little bit more in terms of the specificities of what that commitment and those protections look like. And so I think it's still an open question right now. It's a very brief statement. It's a very open statement. So I am looking forward, and I hope that they are listening, but I am looking forward to working with them and thinking creatively about the different strategies we can come up with to protect the undocumented students and community members while still complying with the kind of limits that the President Killeen sees that we have to work within.
Naomi Paik is an assistant professor in the Department of Asian American Studies at the Urbana campus for the U of I. Thanks for being with us, Naomi.
Thank you so much.
So what will happen on January 21st? Well, Sun Min Kim is a reporter with Politico in Washington, D.C. She's been covering this situation, was just writing about it yesterday, and joins us now from Washington. Sun Min, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So as we're talking about, as you were just listening to, you were just reporting out yesterday, you've been talking to different immigration experts, attorneys. DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is a program that was created by executive action from President Obama. Where would we go from here? Legally, what are the steps President-elect Trump would take if he were to cancel the executive action? What would that mean?
So that means, let's step back a little bit and talk about the directive. Now, that was done by President Obama in 2012 as an executive order. He did not have the explicit consent of Congress to do it. So that means once Donald Trump, once he is sworn in on January 20th, he can roll it back through kind of his own executive memo. And he has promised to do this on the campaign trail. He has said, you know, we're going to get rid of these all unconstitutional executive actions, and he promised to do it if he is elected. Now, legally, there's a couple of different things that he needs to decide, basically what to do with the program. You know, you could issue a memo from the Department of Homeland Security on day one saying, look, as of January 20th, 2017, this program no longer exists. It's no longer valid, and here are the reasons why. Now, if he does choose to take that path, he's going to have to decide whether you want to actually revoke these work permits from the roughly 740,000 so-called Dreamers who have these permits. And that's actually a whole different complicated process, which is something that I learned through reporting a story that my colleague and I posted yesterday. Because of certain federal regulations that dictate this process, it's not enough for the Trump administration to say on day one, look, this program, DACA, is over. They're actually going to have to almost even go case by case, work permit by work permit, to revoke these documents. And now, do they want to go through the trouble and the expense and the use of resources to do that? It's unclear, and that's a question we're going to have for the new administration.
Right. So I think that provides a little clarity, because you're saying even if he does revoke and use his own executive action to say that the program ends, that doesn't necessarily automatically mean that, I think it's 744,000 people who have these permits, that doesn't mean their permits automatically then are no longer valid? Is that what it sounds like you're saying?
That's what lawyers are telling us, and maybe other legal experts have different views, but we talked to experienced immigration attorneys who have dealt with this process, for example, at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, who believe that that's what federal regulations dictate as of right now. So it's not enough for, you know, the Trump administration to say, look, you know, work, you know, employers, this is no longer valid. They actually have to give notice to these individuals who have these work permits, give them 15 days to contest it or file some reasons why they should no longer be able to, or they should be able to keep the work permits and go against the administration. And that's just a major bureaucracy and a major process.
And I guess another option would be to say that the program would expire. The permits right now are for 2 years. Could there just be a process where he says, okay, the program ends, so in 2 years your permit expires and we're not renewing them?
Exactly. And that's kind of a rolling death to DACA, if you will. Now, you know, these 740,000 young immigrants didn't all apply for DACA at the same time. Some may have applied right when the program kind of launched into full effect in summer of 2012. Some may have decided in 2013 that, hey, I want to kind of take the step to go apply for this program. Some may have decided last year. So, I mean, everyone's kind of on a different timeline, a different two-year timeline in terms of when their work permits are set to expire. One person's could end in, you know, March of 2017. One could end at the end of 2018. So what some people are recommending, especially Republicans who don't support the executive actions that the President Obama took, but kind of support the concept of being able to give these so-called dreamers an opportunity in the United States. They're saying, you know, let's kind of phase out the program by not renewing them and not taking new applicants. But it's theoretically that buys Congress time to work out some sort of a bridge action, some sort of a plan for these 740,000 immigrants.
I know, Sungmin, Senator Durbin was on the 21st recently talking about the work that he's doing to try to fix this. He was, of course, the first member of Congress to actually speak about DACA, the first to introduce the DREAM Act. What is he doing working with a bipartisan group in the Senate to try to solve this? You mentioned there were a couple Republicans who are also working on this issue.
So Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois are working with some other senators. The two that we know of so far are Republicans, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Jeff Flake of Arizona. They know each other very well by negotiating the so-called Gang of Eight comprehensive immigration reform bill back in 2013. And they're working on a plan that would say, look, if Trump does revoke this executive order on day one, it'll kind of be status quo for these dreamers who already have these work permits. So no new people, even if they would qualify for the DACA program, but basically make sure that they don't lose their jobs, they're still able to attend school. We're expecting to see more details from Senator Durbin later this week, perhaps tomorrow, before Congress leaves Washington for the holiday recess. And we'll see where that goes. I mean, it's unclear. For Republicans who will control Congress next year are kind of trying to take their cues from the Trump administration on how to deal with this issue. You know, the president-elect actually gave very interesting comments to Time magazine in their story that published this morning about when the magazine chose the president-elect as the person of the year. He seemed to take kind of a softer tone on these dreamers. He didn't say he would back off on repealing this executive order, but he did acknowledge that, you know, these are kids who were brought through no fault of their own. They've built lives here. We'll see what we can do. And actually, while we've been on the phone, Senator Dick Durbin and Senator Lindsey Graham released a joint statement, which is kind of a rare occurrence between a Democrat and a Republican, saying they're really encouraged by these comments from the president-elect.
Oh, wow. So it seems like there's movement even as we speak. Sungmin, we got to take a break. But when we come back, I just wanted to continue this conversation with you. I know when we're thinking particularly about the Illinois delegation, U.S. Representative Luis Gutierrez also had a press conference this morning talking about his solution to this, which would be a presidential pardon. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about that because I know other people have said that that really wouldn't work in this situation either. So if you can hang on for a minute, we'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Lots of conversation and movement today by politicians and other elected officials talking about deferred action for childhood arrivals. That's the DACA program. Earlier this morning, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, along with 18 other mayors from some of our biggest cities and smaller ones across the country, sent a letter to President Trump urging him to continue the program. We've just been talking to political reporter Sungmin Kim in Washington, who's telling us about Senator Dick Durbin releasing a joint statement with his Republican counterpart, Lindsey Graham, saying that President-elect Trump's comments he made this morning about the program, congratulating him, saying this is a step forward. Sungmin, just before the break, we were talking about how politicians are trying to solve this. I mentioned the notion that we're hearing, particularly from Illinois Representative Luis Gutierrez, who's been asking President Obama to issue presidential pardons. And I know there was another news conference about that this morning. What's going on there?
So there are a coalition of House Democrats who actually seem to be growing by the day who really disagree with what the White House has said on whether the outgoing president could pardon dreamers. So a group of members of Congress, including Representative Luis Gutierrez of Illinois and two other key lawmakers from California, have been pushing this pardon issue for about a month now, since after the election. The White House has already said that, look, pardon authorities are used primarily for criminal offenses. It would not give these dreamers legal status anyway. The president is not going to do it. But these group of House Democrats still see a little bit of a wiggle room here. So they sent out another letter this morning, now with about 63 signers, I believe, who endorsed this letter, and held a news conference this morning saying, look, we still believe the president can do this, can pardon these dreamers of their immigration violations, which, remember, immigration violations are civil violations, which is kind of the argument that the White House is making. And, you know, basically urging the president to use his power.
One last question for you. We started this conversation talking about the whole notion of a sanctuary campus. Yesterday, University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen said that that was a term that the university wasn't going to use. It didn't. And it sounds like university officials are saying now it's such a nebulous term. They don't feel like there's a legal definition. They don't want to jeopardize any. They don't want to give any indication that the university isn't going to comply with any federal or state laws. How are colleges across the country handling this? Because we are seeing some colleges saying, like the University of Pennsylvania, yes, we will be a sanctuary campus. And that for us means we will not allow federal immigration authorities on campus unless they have a warrant. What are you seeing colleges across the country? How are they handling this?
Well, they're taking a very different path. I think one of the prominent examples of how universities are defying kind of the incoming Trump administration is the University of California system, who is led by Janet Napolitano, the former Homeland Security Secretary, who actually DACA was enacted under her tenure. So she is obviously a fierce defender of this program. She has been very vocal in saying that the University of California systems will do everything they can to protect these DACA students. And I understand the concern from the Illinois campus officials. They are correct that the sanctuary, we've heard it mostly in the context of sanctuary cities, but now with the Trump election, we're seeing it also in sanctuary campuses. They're absolutely correct that there is no legal definition for what constitutes kind of a sanctuary entity, if you will. So, you know, it could vary between, like, to what extent do local officials cooperate with federal officials? Do they ignore them altogether? Do they send some information about immigrants to federal authorities? But I think there's just I think what you laid out is correct. I think there's been a general standard for these counties, for these campuses, for these cities that have been more of a sanctuary, quote-unquote sanctuary area for immigrants, that they're going to insist on warrants for anything if they're going to do anything beyond, let's say, holding these immigrants, for example, holding them beyond a certain time if they're picked up for some sort of a crime and they're in a local jail. And I think a lot of that is not – a lot of the reasons for the thinking for these sanctuary areas is – not just they want to be, in their view, a more welcoming place for immigrants, and also to make sure that immigrants are still working with local law enforcement officials to, for example, report crimes, but also this has become a constitutional issue. In the last several years, there have been circuit court rulings saying this mandate that, for example, local jails hold immigrants suspected of an immigration violation longer than they would be held if they were, for example, a United States citizen, is actually unconstitutional. So there's that very big concern there as well.
Sungmin Kim is a reporter with Politico in Washington, D.C., joining us to update us on the latest from there. Thanks for being with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicago professor and poet Daniel Borzutsky won this year's National Book Award for Poetry for his collection, The Performance of Becoming Human. It's the third in a series of writing which looks at how people experience and survive different types of state violence, as well as social and political violence. His poetry is an unflinching look at that brutality, tempered by wit, especially as it's experienced by migrants and immigrants. He also teaches in the Department of English Literature and Reading at Wilbur Wright College. It's one of Chicago's City colleges. He's joining us on the line from Chicago now. Daniel, thank you for joining us on the 21st, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What an honor to win a National Book Award. What was your first thought when you heard that you won?
I continue to be surprised. It's an incredible honor, but it's been very surprising.
When I was reading your poetry, to me, it strikes me as prose that's very much political protest. Do you see it that way?
I don't know if it's, I would say more political outrage, perhaps, than protest. I think protest should have a sort of clear target, and I don't know that that's the case in the case of my poetry. I'm not sort of lobbying legislators to change policy, but I think the value of anger as a mode of writing is very important, and one that was certainly fueling me.
And when you talk about that anger, there's a poem, it's actually entitled The Performance of Becoming Human, the title of the book, that caught my attention. And you wrote, "We are dying from so many stories. We cannot compete in the mind from so many stories of burning houses, missing children, slaughtered animals. Who will put the stories back together, and who will restore the bodies?" What inspired that? Because it does strike me that there are so many stories out there that maybe we're missing, or there's just too many, or that really difficult for people to grasp.
Sure. I think I have always thought about, both as a writer and just as a person, one, especially living in a place like Chicago, where you are surrounded by so much violence all the time, if you choose to pay attention to it, right? But on another level, there's a lot of ways of living in Chicago where you cannot pay attention to it. And then if we sort of extract to the world more broadly, right, I think one of the questions that I'm just always wondering and always grappling with is how do we absorb all of the different types of atrocity that we hear about all of the time? How do we live in a place where we know there is murder going on? How do we live in a world, in a country, when we know that there are that there is war and unspeakable types of violence? And I'm thinking about that not just communally, although that's one thing, but also at an individual level. How do you keep yourself from becoming completely overwhelmed by it on the one hand, but while acknowledging it as a reality and as a significant part of your life?
Well, and I think it's interesting because I think so much of your poetry does acknowledge this. And it's, I read something where you said that you think writing creates a political memory in a way. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, well, I should say that the writing that is most interesting to me does that, and that it creates a memory of the, of the time in which you live in various forms, right? So that writing, if it has, of the many purposes it has, I think that's one of them, is to serve as a document of our culture, of our historical and political moments and situations. And so I think that it can do that in a variety of ways, and it doesn't need to do it in a kind of direct journalistic narrative form, right? I think that's where literature becomes interesting, is that it can serve as that kind of document without necessarily factually narrating, but providing at the same time a document of our situation, which might be just as true or more true than, factual narratives.
Well, and then that said, I think it's a really interesting thing if you were to apply that to the 2016, this past year, or almost at the end of the year. What do you think the literal, or what do you think a literature sort of version of that political memory, a literary version of that, would look like for the United States in 2016?
Well, I mean, in some cases, I think we're in a very strange moment where fiction has a very different meaning. Perhaps, I don't know if it's going to be harder or easier to write fiction, right? But if when fiction, and by that I simply mean the idea that our politicians openly lie in such a way that there's not any kind of shame or masking about it, when that becomes the norm, right, then I think the question of what being a fiction writer is going to change to some degree.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. I guess we've been talking so much about politicians. We haven't been talking about fiction writers and how they should view themselves now, right? And I wonder, I mean, especially as you think about that, I'm thinking about you teach in the city colleges in Chicago. I imagine most of your students are first-generation college students, as is typical for community college populations. They may be first-generation American. Did you write, is your poetry for them, for your students? Who did you write this for?
I wouldn't say it's for them, but certainly my experience as an educator in a public environment where public education is being destroyed pretty openly has affected my thinking. So that's certainly in there. I think the experiences that my students bring is also part of it. I have many students who are immigrants and undocumented, and I'm very fearful for them, and I'm very concerned and worried about what might happen to them. And then I think a lot of our students will have very difficult lives and can talk pretty openly to us about what those experiences are. So sure, that has built my vision of Chicago to a certain degree, the discussions I have with my students. So it's certainly been a part of it. I would say that Chicago more broadly, I think, has very much entered into what I'm writing about.
Well, and I think about when you're, so I'm thinking particularly about students, there's the whole immigration issue. I'm also thinking about not just the city of Chicago, but public students attending public universities all across the state of Illinois. I wonder what you think. I'm wondering, you know, so much of your work is about what you think the sort of the social costs of what people are experiencing. I wonder how much you've seen so much of that this year among the student population in terms of the state and its funding and how that's affecting just education, let alone other social services.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen it. I think I've seen it since I started working at the City Colleges, which was in 2004. In my very first semester, we went on strike. That very much brings home the way in which policy decisions at the state level have an impact on individuals. So sort of students right now certainly are struggling, and state grants and scholarship monies are not there. And I think the City Colleges, I know, is experiencing a decrease in the amount of students, and I suppose that is is related to it in some sense. So I think,
I wonder, would you put that in
on one level, on the economic level?
Right.
I think then, in terms of, I also have a 9-year-old who goes to Chicago Public Schools, right? And I think I'm also seeing all of the time the ways in which public school system is defunded, underfunded, privatized, and the effect that that has on actual real people, right? I think we tend to when we talk about policy decisions, we ignore individuals, right? And I think that's one of the things that I try not to do as I'm writing.
Yeah, my last question for you, I don't know if you think, because so much of your work is about violence, would you think that's an appropriate word to use for what we've been talking about? Is that, in terms of when we're thinking about students in the population?
If you distinguish it from physical violence, I think there is such a thing as economic violence. Yes, I think that is, people have long said that economic rights are human rights and that the two are inseparable, right? And that when you deny people of economic rights, you're certainly committing a kind of violence to them. I would distinguish it from blatant physical violence, but it certainly creates the conditions under which a lot of violence occurs.
Thanks for joining us. That's Daniel Barzutsky. He is a Chicago professor. He is a poet. He is the winner of this year's National Book Award for Poetry for his collection, The Performance of Becoming Human. He also teaches at Wilbur Wright College in Chicago. Daniel, congratulations again. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
This is the 21st.
I'm here to see Santa today and ask if I can have my elf back.
My name's Kitty and I'm 9. I'm gonna say I want American Girl doll stuff for Christmas.
I went into a train with a trailer that goes forwards and turns.
And I also want a watch that has our time instead of North Pole time and a few other things I don't know yet.
I was always worried that she was going to be the screaming kid, but she was always really good, real quiet. Last year, she ran up to Santa.
You know, I'm right next to them, and I'm saying, hey, it's fine. You know, it's Santa Claus, and so it's exciting for them. I love it as a mom, of course.
Cecily wasn't super comfortable with the idea of Santa, so she screamed a little bit.
There's a little bit of torture involved here, I think. Well, hopefully she won't remember it. So
I'm of the opinion that if we start her early, then she'll understand this is a friendly experience and not something to be scared about.
Santa is indeed coming to town. Thanks to producer Christine Herman for going to the Marketplace Mall in Champaign to talk to the kids and parents in line waiting to see Santa. In a few minutes, we're going to delve into a little bit more of that sometimes maybe torture experience that parents put their kids through to take those pictures. But first, we're very excited to let you know that Santa's actually right here in studio with us now. Hey, Santa, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I think I should, the first question I think you get asked this by a lot of the kids that you meet is, are you the real Santa?
And I always tell the kids, no, I'm not. But Santa is very busy. And during this time of the year, he's exceptionally busy and he needs some help. And that's where we come in. So I explain to the kids, you know, you tell me what you want. I tell Santa and, you know, it's just an easier way to do it because, you know, Santa can't be everywhere at once.
Okay, so I'm going to call you Santa, understanding that you're a surrogate. Do kids ever ask you for really crazy things when you're talking with them?
I had a pair of twins. Each one of them individually asked for a motorcycle, for a dirt bike. And the second one said he wanted his just to be a little bit faster than his brother's. Not a lot, just a little.
And what's your response?
I always tell them, well, we'll see what we can do. We'll get with mom and dad, and we'll see if we can't work that out.
And what do you do? Do you have kids who get scared or who are a little, how common is it?
It really kind of depends on the child. You can tell when somebody brings up a little baby.
You can tell right away how the child is going to react.
You can tell that the child has been, I don't want to say socialized, but, you know, they're used to being passed around. So, you know, being passed to somebody different isn't that big a deal to them. And yet some kids, they're screaming before it's their turn in line. And you just try and make them feel comfortable. Sometimes, you know, mom or dad has to stay with them for the picture.
And when you see that child, so you're in line and you see the screaming child 3 down, what goes through Santa's head at that point?
Santa's head goes, gee, I hope I can calm this child down because I don't want this to be a bad experience for them. I don't want them to be afraid of Santa. Santa's a good guy, and there's enough not good guys out there that they need a good guy.
Sure. So what do you do to try to calm them down or make them feel comfortable?
Just what you would with any little kid. It's like, oh, come on, I'm okay. And I had one child that, for whatever reason, was freaked out that I had the white gloves on. So I took the white gloves off and showed him that they're just hands.
They're just hands. And, yeah, that would be a little weird.
You know, just little things to try and let them be comfortable that Santa's pretty much just like them. He just has a fun job.
So we have another guest who's going to join us in a minute to give us some more professional advice as well. She's a pediatrician, but since you're Santa, what would you say? What is your advice for parents, other adults who are bringing children to have this picture? What should they do to prepare?
The little ones that you're afraid might be upset, try and explain to them what you're doing, why they're doing this. Don't expect them to understand from watching it on TV or, you know, reading them the night before Christmas. It's some kids, it's scary for them. And just explain to them that it's not going to be a bad experience.
Sid, I know you're busy, so you got to go. So
yep.
Thank you for coming by.
Busy time of the year.
I know it's getting to be a busy time for you. So, you know, as we heard, kids and parents are already lining up to see Santa, to sit in his lap, to tell him all the things they want for Christmas. If all goes well, you walk away with that perfect photo, which we know is the goal here. Everyone wants a perfect photo of your kid with Santa, but sometimes that always doesn't go as planned, especially when we're telling children to be careful of strangers. So for the adults out there that worry your child will be the one that freaks out when you place them on the lap of the strange man with the big white beard, we have an expert here also to help. Dr. Jennifer Snyder is a pediatrician with Memorial Physician Services in Springfield. She's also a mother of two young children herself. Dr. Snyder, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you start off? We were just hearing, it makes sense why some kids, children might be afraid to meet Santa. Can you help us understand a little bit more about that?
Sure. So I would say a child anywhere from age 1 to roughly 6, that would be a pretty normal experience for them to go through. Probably the highest peak part, though, would be anywhere from age 1 to 3. And some of that just all stems from, the development at that point. Just as you mentioned, we do kind of talk to children about strangers and how we don't want to just go up and talk to strangers. But even in those younger ages, you know, stranger anxiety / separation anxiety are a normal developmental stage for any of those children.
And at what age do you normally see kids developing that anxiety? Is that normally we start seeing that as young as maybe a little, like maybe just before 2?
Yeah, or even, you know, a little bit younger too. Even in my office, when kids come in for that 1 year visit, they can already show anxiety with just the pediatrician themselves, since they're someone different from mom and dad.
What do you think parents should do to prepare their kids to see Santa?
I think a lot of it has to do with taking a step back to think about why your child might be a little bit anxious about Santa. You know, it can be something as simple as his clothing is different, his voice is different, his beard is different, maybe even just, you know, the fact, like I said, that he's a stranger in general. And so trying to familiarize your child first with some of that. And, you know, I heard Santa say that, you know, just watching movies and reading books is not a perfect answer, although I think it will help a little bit to familiarize your child with Santa. I do think that if you can, doing a little bit of a trial run with your child, so taking them beforehand so they can see him from afar, maybe watching some of the other kids sit on his lap, and taking away some of that anxiety of having to sit, being almost thrown on his lap, is always a good idea.
Is it sort of maybe even as you're reading stories about Santa, saying, and hey, we're going to go see Santa.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of that kind of preparation too, so they know.
Yeah. And then when you do finally go and talk to Santa, you know, kids look at their parents basically for security. And so if their parents are giving them a lot of vibes and they've done this prep work to say that, you know, Santa's okay, look, mom's going to sit by Santa, mom's going to tell Santa what I want for Christmas, that kind of stuff, that may help reduce some of that anxiety. But in the end, if they're still highly anxious and still putting their arms out, there's no reason why you can't sit on Santa's lap or right next to him for the
right.
photo.
Well, and I guess it sounds like for everybody, it's really about adjusting expectations for everyone.
Right.
And I guess I'm talking about not just on the child side, but mostly on the adult side.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's becoming even more common now that people, as almost a joke, are posting their pictures, Santa fail or whatnot, when their child is screaming on his lap and putting their
right.
hands out, realizing that it's not just my child, that's just the developmental stage they're at.
Right. And so as we think about this, what's kind of the worst thing for a parent to do in this situation?
I think the worst thing is to reprimand your child and make them feel bad for being anxious, or, you know, take away privileges or anything, as if there's something wrong with them for feeling that way.
And how would you balance the sort of the obviously the whole message of Santa's not necessarily a stranger, but how do you weigh both of those things of we want you to take a picture with this guy versus you need to be careful around strangers? Do you just say Santa's an exception, or how would you recommend parents frame that?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, you just talk to him about the difference, and that if you're providing reassurance that, you know, I'm going to talk to Santa, and it's okay to talk to Santa, but other people, and explain that to them, the difference there, then I think your child will understand. Obviously, if they're a little bit older, not that younger age bracket, that 1 to even 3 years of age. But, you know, I think you talk about, too, how there are certain safe people and then other people that are not safe to talk to.
And you have a 3-year-old, right? And a 16-month-old?
I do.
So what have you said to your 3-year-old, Dr. Snyder?
Well, it's funny, you know, for the past 2 years, we've gone to see Santa. And last year, my 3-year-old, who obviously was 2 at the time, she was highly anxious about Santa. So I ended up in the picture. This year at 3, she wasn't anxious anymore, but my now 16-month-old was very anxious. So I've been in the photo the past 2 years because despite doing everything, reading the books and talking to them and watching some movies and stuff, you know, it's
sometimes it just doesn't work.
Right. I realize that it's just a normal developmental stage for them. And, you know, it's kind of funny. We can talk about it later why I was in the photos for those 2 years.
Oh, that's good. So maybe it was also, I think, because do you think maybe it's also, again, that was you saying, okay, it's okay for me to be in the picture as an adult. Maybe people will think it's cute. And if they don't, that's just life.
Right. Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Dr. Jennifer Schneider. She's a pediatrician in Springfield at Memorial Physician Services. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Merry Christmas.
Before we go, we just wanted to update you on a story that we've been following. Last week, we spoke with Dean Dempsey. He's a member of the Navajo Nation and a resident of Danville. He talked to us about what it was like to travel to the Sacred Stone Camp in Cannonball, North Dakota, last month to join people who had gathered there to protest the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. You probably heard the news this weekend. The Army Corps of Engineers announced that they had denied permits for construction a key portion of the pipeline, which would have passed near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and under a Missouri River reservoir. We wanted to follow up with Dean Dempsey after that big announcement. Our colleagues at WILL talked to him just after he heard the news.
I wish I was there to hear the songs and the drums of happiness and prayers. And they told me that they had a huge a prayer circle around the camp. I mean, all the way around the camp, maybe 3/4 to a mile long and about the same wide. So, you know, all these people holding hands and saying prayer, thanking the Creator and praying that this wind keeps on continuing and we totally kill the snake and send it back where it came from.
He added that the fight is just beginning since President-elect Donald Trump is taking office in about 6 weeks and the President-elect has indicated his support for the Dakota Access Project.
So things could change, and right now we're just taking this as a pause, and we're just waiting to see what the new president's going to do with their new possibilities. The battle's not over, but this win is very exciting and very inspirational, and, you know, I thank the Creator for all the veterans that came to help fight this. I thank the Creator for all their water protectors and America. Our government has failed us, but the American people have stepped up and have heard our voices.
Thanks to WILL reporter Jeff Bossert for that audio of Dean Dempsey, a Danville resident and member of the Navajo Nation. We'll tweet out the full conversation we had with Dean last week about his trip, why he originally went to Standing Rock to protest. We also spoke to a reporter who was there covering everything. If you follow us at 21STShow for that. By the way, you can always follow us on Twitter. I said 21STShow. During the show, we're always tweeting out background material and context about the things we're talking about on air. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the 21st, we're going to be talking about what supercomputers have to do with arts and humanities. We're going to speak to researchers about an eDream project. It's a collaboration with the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. Lots going on with Illinois politics this week. We're going to catch up on that. We're also going to talk with the Chicago band Grandkids about their new album, This Guitars. You might remember they had an album 3 years ago. They got their start actually in the Champaign-Urbana area. It was one of the most popular albums. So we're going to catch up with them. Their new album's just about to come out. You can always find past shows for us on the NPR One app if you search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All those links, every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. Again, our Twitter handle, 21stshow. If you look for our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments that you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Howla Delahey, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.